up your ears. Fun Drive is here. Become radio's best friend this year by donating now at cjsffundrive.ca or simply text the word donate to 778-782-2573 and be radio's best friend.
The following is a special CJSF presentation. It interrupts regularly scheduled programming in this time slot.
I believe in living.
I believe in the spectrum of beta days and gamma people.
I believe in sunshine and windmills and waterfalls, tricycles and rocking chairs. And I believe that seeds grow into sprouts and sprouts grow into trees.
I believe in the magic of the hands and in the wisdom of the eyes.
I believe in rain and tears. And in the blood of infinity. I believe in life.
I believe in life. And I have seen the death parade march through the torso of the earth.
Sculpting mud bodies in this path. I've seen the destruction of the daylight.
And seen bloodthirsty maggots prayed to and saluted. I have seen the kind become the blind.
And the blind become the bind.
In one easy lesson. I have walked on cut glass, I have eaten crow and blunder bread, and breathed the stench of indifference.
I've been locked by the lawless, handcuffed by the haters, gagged by the greedy. And if I know anything at all,
it's that a wall is just a wall and nothing more at all.
It can be broken down. I believe in living. I believe in birth.
I believe in the sweat of love and in the fire of truth. And I believe that a lost ship, steered by tired, seasick sailors,
can still be guided home to port.
This program is part 5 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors. Or do they? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided. Part 5 focuses on the global rise of new border walls, their inability to stop human migration, and their devastating impact on the migration patterns of animal life around the world. This program is dedicated to the people and animals whose ability to thrive is constrained by walls.
Every street is paved gold, and it's just across the borderline. And when it's time to take your turn, here's a lesson you must learn. You could lose more than you ever hope to find. And when you reach,
we're probably within 200 or 300 yards of the fence, and it's invisible. This is like when you look overhead, there aren't any Mexican stars or American stars. It's like a great biological unity with a meat cleaver of law cutting it in half. If you look to the north, northeast, you can see the glow of the lights of Tucson. And if you look down at your feet, they're going to have to move constantly for 3 days to get there. And they don't, you know, they can't move during the day much. After about 11 a.m., the heat will knock them down. They follow the person in front of them. They fall a lot. And they're afraid. They're afraid of the desert at night anyway. It's a different desert when you're being hunted. They've spent their life as human beings. They cross the wire. They become a deer surrounded by lions. The only thing you can really hear out here are insects and fear. hundreds of square miles, just crackling with fear.
We're out here on the borders with our favorite few possessions, trading stories whispered round the fire. There's shadows in the searchlights, mugshots in the files, waiting in the camps behind the wire. Kick the door until it opens. What you have you cannot hold. We are young, forever hungry. You are fat and growing old. And every day you try to build a higher wall.
My name is Elizabeth Vallet. I am a border scholar. I work at the University of Quebec at Montreal and also at the Canadian Royal Military College of Saint-Jean in Canada. I am the head of a team on border fences and border walls that has been hosting a conference every 2 years in Montreal for since 2009, I think. So every 2 years, we get all the scholars from all around the world who work on border walls, and they come to Montreal. When I started working on border fences more than a decade ago, the first question, like, it was really not in fashion, and nobody was talking about border walls as a global phenomenon. We were starting to feel outside of the US the aftermath of 9/11 on borders, but you know, the main narrative was still about open borders and flows and commerce and what have you. But we could see that border walls were popping here and there around the world. So in 2009, I got a grant from the National Council of Canada, Social Science Research Council of Canada, to study border fences. And it was interesting, like everybody would be looking at me and saying, you work on border walls, really? So it seemed quite odd. And since I couldn't seem to be able to find, you know, big articles or books on the border walls as a global phenomenon, I said, well, maybe we should get people to talk together and see what can come up with that. So we organized our first conference in Montreal in 2009, and surprisingly enough, we had many people coming from all over the world who said at the end of the conference, let's do that again. So we've done that in 2011 and so on. So we've missed a few years with COVID, but we met again last October. And the next meeting will be in May 2025. What's interesting about those conferences is that we get people from all over the world, as I said, from India, Japan, Chile, what have you, so everywhere in the world. But also we get people from different fields. So we've had artists, biologists, medical doctors. We're speaking about border walls built during pandemic. We've had lawyers, geographers. So it's a super interesting and fun conference because people get together. Nobody's in the same field, or we've got some more geographers and political scientists, but still. So nobody's competing for, you know, the spotlight, and we reshare ideas. And we've discovered that we had many things to put in common in order to understand border walls as a global phenomenon. There are many reasons why those border walls are popping around the world. But the one we came up with when we started working on border fences and border walls was interesting. We assumed in 2009 that the trigger was 9/11. So we suspected, our hypothesis was that the number of border walls would be declining after the fall of the Berlin Wall and would be going up after 9/11. So we started counting the walls, literally. And at the time, before, you know, social media, and it's really funny how like 10 years does make a difference. We really had to to look at bloggers, like people were traveling and taking pictures, bloggers, we would be calling journalists in those countries saying, we've heard about maybe a border fence, could you tell us more? So it was really like, oh, today the data collection is super easy. We just go on social media, ask our question, we've got so many answers and pictures. But we started counting them. And we've discovered that actually the number of border walls didn't decline that much after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that the number began going up before 9/11. So it was already like the growth of fortified borders was already on the tables before 9/11. So 9/11 wasn't the trigger, it was the accelerator, meaning that it wasn't a security-oriented response right away, but it was more an identity one, aimed at globalization. Like open borders did lead to a backlash of fortified borders. This being said, now it's once again a different ballgame. Things have changed, and somebody like Donald Trump has played a huge role in the banalization of the fortification, of wallification. It's become, he made it almost trendy to say, hey, we don't know how to deal with that problem, poof, let's build a wall. So Hungary is one, of course, and Finland, for instance, who just got into NATO, has been building is building a fence as we speak with the border of Russia, the Baltic states, Calais between the UK and France, or in France, but on the way to the UK. Spain has been fencing its own enclaves in Morocco, Ceuta and Melilla for a long time. So suddenly with Donald Trump, and he, once again, he's not a trigger, he's an accelerator himself, we've seen border walls being erected on the periphery or at the border of democracies. And more so. You have those big democracies, such as the USA, Israel, and India, who had already experimented the process. But there again, they've been going further, deeper under the ground, higher up, with more technologies, more experimentations, robots, drones, what have you. So there are many factors, and but the thing is, the trend doesn't seem to be slowing down, to say the least. It keeps on accelerating, and we keep on fortifying, knowing that they don't work, which is kind of odd, isn't it? Last October, we were in Montreal for that conference when the Prime Minister of Finland confirmed that they would be testing a pilot, a border fence, at the border between Finland and Russia. My colleague, Jussi Laine, who is from the University of Eastern Finland, started tweeting, saying, hey, we're in the midst of a conference talking about that. We've got people in front of you telling us that it's not working. Why don't you listen to us? They are still building the fence. Although we've told them it's costly, it doesn't prevent people from coming in. It's purely symbolic, and that money could be put elsewhere. What we really think, which is it's a huge amount of money, just for show. It's theater. It's spectacle. That's what Professor Wendy Brown has said already more than a decade ago, saying, you know, it's just a show. And it's a way, it's a symbol. It's a way to say, hey, we don't know what to do, but let's do that. People can see it. And it's really rewarding from an electoralist point of view. We have built in Montreal a huge new bridge, and we look at that bridge and we use it every day. And building a wall is putting the same amount of money, but not using it, literally. It's a massive amount of concrete. Most of the time it's made, at least the foundations are made out of concrete. And it can go up to several million dollars a kilometer, a mile. And then you've got maintenance. I remember being in Friendship Park at the border between San Diego and Tijuana. So we were there, and I was talking to one of the border patrol, and he said, oh yes, it's a few years back, maybe 5 or 6 years back, we've put a roll of barbed wire of concertina on top of that. It was before Trump, on top of the fence over there. It cost us $8 million. It took them being the traffickers, a week to figure out that at Home Depot or what have you, like you could just buy, you know, a saw that could cut through the barbed wires for $29.99. So trying to prevent flows from coming in is like trying to retain water with your hands. It will go around on one side. And on the other side, yes, the huge amounts of money to do nothing doesn't make sense.
زوروني كل سنة مرة
that our colleagues, people like John Linnell from Norway or Titley, for instance, have documented the environmental impact. And that's the price tag we often forget when we look at how much does a wall cost, is how much will it cost, environmentally speaking, in the relatively short term. How many ecosystems will be destroyed? How many springs, natural springs, freshwater sources will be destroyed because we will need that water to build the wall, to make the concrete to build the wall? So this is relatively a short-term cost. But there is a longer-term cost, and that has been documented by Mark Titley, who is an environmentalist, who has, with his colleague, colleagues documented the fact that as climate change is making animals move to find their natural niche, what they are saying is in three countries, but mainly in the US, for instance, there are many animals, species, that will have to move north to keep on surviving, to find their niche. But the problem is with the border wall, they will be stopped from doing that. So on a longer term, which is not that long, but longer than what I talked about previously, they will not be able to adapt and they will disappear. Border walls are built usually, so those are physical fortifications, literally. We've defined those border walls. We've tried to define them differently or differentiate them from just a roll of barbed wire, let's say, along a border like there are many around the world, but really they have like masonry foundations. That's how we've defined them. And they are meant to prevent flows, whichever way they go. And those are, although borders are bilaterally defined by the two countries, the two neighbors, border walls are most of the time unilaterally defined. So it's one country building the wall and exploiting the other in a way, or trying to hide its neighbor. Usually on top of those walls, you have many elements that will be added, whether it will be a additional road or lights or sensors or cameras that can be far away from even that zone. You can have robots, armed robots. There are many, many elements. And in some places, the border fence is here for sure, but the main elements of the borders are the fortification in terms of technology. So there is really a will to enlarge the border line to a real border zone, which is often the case, with many, many elements that do not belong to the masonry or the concrete itself, but complement it and will help control the border. And if you go in the Rio Grande Valley, for instance, which I think is the most impressive in terms of surveillance, you feel like there are always eyes on you wherever you go. And the number of police enforcement or law enforcement officers from many different institutions, the number of cameras, the number of mobile cameras, the number of eyes literally always on you is almost suffocating. So there is a traditional reason why border walls are built between two countries, and it's really a post-conflict security apparatus. Between India and Pakistan, for instance, the wall was a way to freeze the border. And we've seen that between the two Cypruses, between the North and South Korea. So there are many countries that have found a way to establish a negative peace through the border fence. And those are more traditional reasons we see here and there, countries that are still doing it, but sometimes using another argument. So let's say Finland is building a fence with Russia, and the main argument they're using is to prevent immigration from Russians who are fleeing Putin's regime into Finland. It's not, I think, that they believe it's going to work, but it's a way to underline that border and say, just in case you hadn't noticed, it's here. But the other reasons, whether it is trafficking or smuggling or terrorism or immigration, those three are fairly recent in a way. And immigration is a big chunk of the new border fences that have been built in Europe or outside of, on the periphery of Europe between US and Mexico, etc. It's interesting to see how things are changing on your northern border with Canada. For a long time, Canada has tried as much as it could to keep, you know, the border between Canada and the US as something that was everyday life, low politics. Like there was no reason to bring that into the parliament, and we weren't talking about it. It would be dealt with, and it was dealt with that way, because commerce was so important, and we didn't want the US to look at us the way they look at Mexico and the border with Mexico. But that has changed in recent years, because first of all, during the US presidential elections, more and more we hear about the security and the northern border, which is something that wasn't that clear 10 years ago, but has really changed recently. And even on our side of the border, some politicians, more populist, are beginning to use the border as a tool to maybe instill fear and maybe get elected. And so the discourse is changing. It is interesting to go at the foot of the wall and see how oppressive it is. There is something about the wall, the sense of being enclosed in a way. So that's one thing. On the other hand, what's interesting is the further you are from the border, the more opinions you will get. So, and we see that also for the northern border, like the congressmen that are, you know, somewhere lost in the Midwest will have like strong opinions about how to close the border, fence the border, etc. What's also interesting about borderlands is that for a long time they've been literally peripheral from the state. So not only were they at the periphery, but they weren't central to the politics of the states. And after 9/11, it's true that it has changed. But that has two consequences. Because it's peripheral, it's often left, it has all, been left alone in a way for a long time. So if you go in the Rio Grande Valley, you've got the, let's say, the Butterfly Center, which is a place that has been left alone, where you can see butterflies like you've never seen, or even being in the in some of the parks in the Rio Grande Valley, you sit there and you realize how much you have forgotten how birds sing. You hear so many of them, which used to be like, you know, if you stay back in time, you remember what it was during your childhood, but it's the case in many borderlands. On the other hand, because it was the periphery, the state was free to experiment, and experiment in terms of police, in terms of technology, in terms of surveillance. There is, and that's interesting to see how all those, that big military industrial complex, which was key during the Cold War, just mutated in a way and became a security industrial complex and has invested a lot in border security and has been able to experiment in those borderlands because the accountability was not the same. And the proof of that is the 100-mile zone, for instance. The fact that you have that zone of 100 miles inland in the U.S., where the American Civil Liberty Union speaks about the Constitution free zone, because it's, yes, the U.S., but legally speaking, maybe a little less. Maybe there is a little more freedom for law enforcement or for those kind of behaviors that are, wouldn't be tolerated, let's say, downtown D.C.
Of this earth, I'm born of this earth, I breathe of this earth, and even with the pain, I believe in this earth. So I wake up every morning and I'm stepping on the floor. I wake up every morning and I'm stepping out the door. I got faith in the sky, faith in the one, faith in the people rocking underneath the sun. Cause every bit of land is a holy land, and every drop of water is a holy water, and every single child is a son or a daughter of the one earth mama and the one earth papa. So don't tell a man that he can't come here, cause he got brown eyes and a wavy kind of hair. And don't tell a woman that she can't go there, because she prays a little different to a God up there.
Artist, refugee. The chopper's gut from so far below was the smooth belly of a shark. I didn't bother to wave or holler. Its elegant gray arcing away was the last line I loved. This poem came to me when I was swimming, doing the backstroke, and a helicopter passed overhead. And I thought about refugees who had drowned in deep waters. And I thought about their last moments, and I thought about their humanity and how so many in the last part of their life were just known to the world as refugees. And I thought about their passions and their talents and their identities, what makes them each uniquely human.
Children, why do we build the wall?
Why do we build the wall? We build the wall to keep us free. That's why we build the wall. We build the wall to keep us free.
How does the wall keep us free? My children, how does the wall keep us free?
This is part five of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? A series of programs about borders, walls, and fences, visible or invisible, that keep us in, keep us out, and keep us divided.
My name is Jeremiah Leibowitz. I serve as the executive director for an organization called Cuenca Los Ojos, which is headquartered in Arizona and also has a sister organization of the same name in the country of Mexico in the state of Sonora. And our work primarily focuses on watershed and habitat restoration on a very large landscape scale sized project, specifically in Sonora. And as well, we've got another project in Chihuahua, Mexico that we manage. But in essence, we focus on nature-based solutions to restore habitat, to restore watersheds, to improve biodiversity. And specifically in arid regions of the world. So the work that we focus on is in the Sonoran Chihuahuan Desert, but we believe that a lot of the work that we are doing could be replicated in other similarly situated parts of the world. I won't take credit for the name. It existed before I joined the organization, but in Spanish, the term cuenca is a generic term used to describe watersheds, right? So cuenca los ojos, a lot of people are like, you know, the eyes, that's what los ojos translates to.